You're listening to the free edition of Sweden in Focus from The Local. If you would like to listen to a full-length version of the podcast, as well as an additional midweek episode, please check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade to Membership Plus. Here's this week's free edition.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to Sweden in Focus, the Local's weekly news podcast. We are recording this episode on Thursday, the 19th of October. And today we're going to talk about how much COVID-19 there is in circulation and what you need to know about vaccinations. We'll look at how far along the government has come with its plans to revoke permanent residency from asylum seekers. We'll ask why so many interesting social initiatives in Sweden have been set up by immigrants. And finally, we'll delve into the biggest Swedish news story of the week, the murder in Brussels of two Swedish football fans by a gunman who pledged allegiance to the Islamic State terrorist group. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and with me today from Malmö are the Local's Emma Lovgren and Richard Orange. How are you both?
Very well.
Yeah, I'm okay, thanks.
Good. Well, let's get straight into it then. And we'll start with a quick COVID-19 update. Judging from my own friends and family, variants of the virus are definitely back after the summer. But what are the figures telling us?
Hardly anyone gets tested anymore. So it's we don't have the kind of graphs that we had in when COVID was at its peak. But at the end of September, the Public Health Authority tested 1,600 people at random. And they found that about 1.5% of them had COVID, which is about the same level as in March 2020, and quite a lot more than in the last, they call it a stick prove. I don't know how it translates into English, but in the last such test, which was in September last year. The good news from the study really is that 93% of the population have antibodies against COVID-19, which is pretty much what you'd expect, because I think 93.5% of people have had more than two jabs. So it shows that the jabs are giving people immunity, or not necessarily immunity, but protection. And of the positive results that they found, which was only 30 out of 1,600 people, 12 were variants of Omicron BA5.2, which was the one that was behind the last big wave of COVID in 2022, and 7 were the newer Omicron BF7, which emerged at the end of 2022. But hardly anyone's ill. So there are 381 patients in hospital yesterday who had COVID, according to the Board of Health and Welfare. And about 3/4 of those they're there because of the COVID, you know, so probably like 300 or something actual COVID patients. And that's a lot more than July, when there were only about 70, but a lot less than the last peak in December last year, when there were about 2,000 people in hospitals. So yeah, I mean, it's less bad than it was this time last year, I think. And when you look at people who are seriously ill, the number of people in intensive care, it's about one a day, and then a death every sort of 3 or 4 days.
So we had a question from a reader this week asking who should get vaccinated and when. What are the recommendations at the moment?
So we're coming up both on COVID and also just the normal flu season. So I'll talk you through both of those. So let's start with the COVID vaccine, Paul. Recommendations vary a little bit depending on like how old you are, if you have an underlying health condition, if you've been vaccinated before, and so on. But kind of the basic general picture is that if you're older than 65, or if you have an underlying health condition, and that also includes pregnancy, then the Swedish recommendations say that you should get vaccinated this winter, even if you've been vaccinated before. If you're between 50 and 64 and you haven't previously been vaccinated, you should make sure to get a dose this winter. But if you've already been vaccinated, you don't have to, according to these recommendations. Now, for the rest of us who are over 18, there's no recommendation at all to get vaccinated. Like, you don't even have to get a booster or get vaccinated for the first time. Now, you can still get vaccinated, and the COVID vaccine is still free for everyone in Sweden. For teenagers under the age of 18, they should only get vaccinated if their doctor recommends it. but everyone else can get another booster dose even if they don't belong to a risk group. And you can get vaccinated against COVID at any time, so you can just go and get a vaccination now if you want to. But you may want to wait until after November 7th, because that's when the updated vaccine is expected to be available in Sweden, which is more sort of adapted to the kind of variants that are around now. And it's also when the vaccination campaign for the seasonal flu gets underway. So if you're hoping to get vaccinated against both COVID and the flu in one go, then it might be easier to wait. If you're in a risk group for the flu, you get the vaccine for free. If you're not in a flu risk group, you have to pay for it. It usually costs around like 200 to 400 kronor or something like that. And you also may have to wait a few weeks until everyone in risk groups has had a chance to get the flu vaccine.
Okay, great. Thanks for filling us in. And we'll link to our article on the latest recommendations in the episode notes. On to politics now, and the government's plans to limit asylum immigration to the bare minimum required by European Union law. Now, this is at the core of the TIDA agreement, the deal the three-party coalition signed with its support party, the far-right Sweden Democrats, and is a large part of why the Sweden Democrats agreed to the deal. Now, a couple of weeks ago, the government launched an inquiry that is going to look at things like revoking permanent residency from people who received permits on asylum grounds and how to recall asylum status from applicants no longer deemed to be under threat in their home countries. And we'll talk to our panelists about this in a few moments. But first, let's listen to a short excerpt from a recent interview Richard carried out with the Sweden Democrats' immigration policy spokesman, Ludvig Aspling. So we'll hear Aspling's thoughts on what his party is learning from its proximity to the government. But first, we listen to his response to a claim from the Migration Minister, Maria Malmö Stenergard, that it might not be possible to rescind a positive administrative decision, such as the awarding of a permanent residency permit.
Of course it's possible. Why would we waste time on pressing the issue if it wasn't possible? That wouldn't make any sense. We have a lot of stuff to do. It would make zero sense to work on something if it's not legally possible. Of course it is.
How smooth has the process been of it with the government parties of kind of discussing what should be in this inquiry and what the chair should look at? And are there any things you've disagreed on that you've wanted to put in but you haven't been able to convince the other parties to put into it? And vice versa, anything that they wanted to take out that they've had to keep?
We all stand behind the document as it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, the directives are negotiated, obviously, between the four parties. We all stand behind it. And I think it's a fair compromise. It's you know, public knowledge that we don't have the same sort of ideological standpoint, all four parties. Mm-hmm. So everything that we do is a compromise. So obviously, it's been a little bit of a back and forth until we were done. But we all stand behind the text, and I'm happy with that. As to the question of like how smooth has the process been, very hard for me to answer because I've never been part of any other coalition government, so I don't really know. It's hard for me to compare. You have to come back maybe after the next parliamentary period and ask me and say, well, is it more smooth now than it was before? Maybe I can give you a good answer.
Now, that was Ludvig Aspling from the Sweden Democrats, and there were lots of interesting takeaways from the interview, and we'll link in the notes to Richard's article. Now, it's interesting here that he says the Sweden Democrats have never been part of any other coalition. I mean, the fact is they're not part of this coalition government either. They just signed an agreement to back the three-party coalition government as long as it enacts policies they've agreed on. So to what extent have they become embedded in the workings of government while officially still being outside of it?
Aspling certainly talked as if they are part of the government. He said how exciting it was to be able to see how government works from the inside for the first time. You know, how he's been an MP, but he's always been just in Parliament. He hasn't seen the workings of government from inside the government offices. And he also talked about how steep the learning curve had been for the Sweden Democrats within the government offices for the first 6 months, he said. He said now they know the ropes, but for 6 months, he said, there was a huge amount to learn. And he said that as a result of that, he thinks the party is much stronger as a result, because it knows how government inquiries work, how the civil service works, how, you know, just the sort of thing that the Social Democrats are known for being masters of, you know, and yeah. he feels that the Sweden Democrats are now kind of getting that secret knowledge, not secret knowledge, but so I thought that was kind of interesting. And he also said that the next time, as you said, that the Sweden Democrats get into power, they will be in a much better position to use it. It's not an accident that they feel part of government, because the way the TTIP agreement works, there are quite a lot of things they agreed to bring in, which do leave the Sweden Democrats in a kind of halfway house. So even though they're right. not officially a party of the government, because that would have been, for a start, like too much for most moderate voters and definitely Liberal Party voters to stomach, they actually kind of are. And the first one of those is, there's this thing called the Coordination Council, which is a sort of committee in the government offices, which is the civil service, who start a lot of legislation and do the kind of work behind a lot of legislation. And they're supposed to be kind of mostly apolitical in Sweden. And there's six Sweden Democrat appointed civil servants who sit on the Coordination Council. And then they work with counterparts from the moderates, Christian Democrats and Liberals on developing policies. And it gives them a view on the ground of how the policy is being developed and whether the TTIP agreement is being fulfilled. So that gives them a real place inside the machinery of government. And the second big part of the TTIP agreement that gives them externally a sense that they're part of the government is that spokespeople from the Sweden Democrats are able to lead press conferences alongside government ministers to announce the policies that are part of the agreement. So, for example, I don't think they did have a press release on this inquiry to reduce immigration to the EU minimum, but, you know, Aspling has quite often stood alongside Maria Malmer Stenergaard to announce various policies, as have other senior Sweden Democrats. So I think for the public, that gives the sense that it's them who's driving this forward in a way that a support party wouldn't normally have. You know, it gives them the external sense that they are the people driving this policy.
And how do voters view the collaboration between the government and the Sweden Democrats in terms of who people think runs the show?
Well, I mean, you heard that Richard said that the Sweden Democrats already feel like they're pretty much in government. And that's a view that voters share as well, by and large.
Yeah.
Actually, the DN newspaper, they recently published a poll that found that voters kind of feel that the Sweden Democrats are the ones that are running the show, despite not actually having any minister posts. So 57% told that poll that the Sweden Democrats had a big impact on the government's policies, which was actually more than the number of people who said the same about the moderates, who are, you know, in theory, the party that is running the government. And as Richard explained, that's perhaps not surprising, because they have been very influential, like especially on migration issues, but possibly also like indirectly on issues like the government abandoning pretty much large parts of Sweden's climate policies, for example, which we've talked about before on the podcast.
What did Aspling tell you about the most controversial questions, like taking permanent residency away from asylum seekers or sending people back to countries that they deem safe?
Well, he kind of said that your readers, because I kind of approached it by saying, you know, our readers are very concerned about this. He goes, your readers have got nothing to fear, because this is a permanent residency is only going to be taken away from people who have come to Sweden on asylum. So people who've got permanent residency on a work permit will be able to keep their permanent residencies.
Yeah.
Which I think says something about how he views asylum seekers, because, you know, quite a lot of our readers and perhaps did come here on asylum and still work as computer programmers or whatever. And on sending people home whose countries are safe, he was quite callous about it. I mean, he went further than the government in Denmark, for instance, who have said that if you come from a region in Syria that's safe, you should go back. He's saying that if anywhere in your home country is safe, so for example, Mogadishu in Somalia, you should go back, because you can be safe in your home country somewhere.
And this very controversial plan of taking permanent residency away from people, they would say that, you know, it's a pathway to citizenship for people, right? So they want to make citizenship more attractive. If you've been here for a long time, you shouldn't just be a permanent resident. You should strive to become a citizen. But then there will be a lot of people who don't meet the criteria, presumably.
Yeah, especially seeing as that they're changing it from 5 years in Sweden to 8 years in Sweden. They're making it harder to become a citizen at the same time as they're taking away permanent residency from people earlier. So yeah, no, if they made it easier to become a citizen, I think that would be an easier argument to make. And also, I mean, what he said is, if you've been living here in Sweden and you haven't got a job and you don't fulfill the terms of citizen, you know, you can't support yourself to the extent that you can become a citizen, then you really shouldn't be here. You know, if you've been here 5 years and you're still unemployed, then go home. And he was. He was just like, go home, leave. It was interesting because he's very he's a lawyer. He's taught English in China for quite a few years. He's married to a Japanese woman, so he's quite cosmopolitan in a sense, and his English is absolutely perfect. And he's very fluent in English. But at the same time, he has quite radical views on immigration. It was quite interesting. As a kind of the new type of Sweden Democrat, he's definitely from the more polished, lawyerly type of Sweden Democrat, of which there are quite a few in the government offices. I thought it was quite interesting to talk to him, actually, because I've spoken to the old guard quite a lot in the past. So it was interesting
You're more used to talking to the rural Scanians.
I'm more used to talking to the kind of Scanian guy who has his own entrepreneur business, you know, who has a, you know, 12 diggers and, you know, is a small businessman. Yeah, I'm more used to those guys. And so it's kind of interesting to talk to the guy who's like international lawyer, traveled all over the world, but is a Sweden Democrat.
And I recommend listeners to go to your article and read more, because it was a very interesting interview. Regular listeners may remember that we partnered before the summer with Stockholm Academic Forum, and we've renewed that partnership now to let you know about their Stockholm Explorative Talks, which is a unique and fascinating event that you really should attend if you have a chance. It takes place at the Royal College of Music in Stockholm on Thursday, the 9th of November. And the theme this year is polarization versus pluralism, which, as we've spoken about on this podcast before, is something Sweden badly needs to address if, for example, it's to tackle the corrosive effects of segregation. The way the event works is that academics from Stockholm's 18 universities and higher education institutions meet with artists and business representatives in interdisciplinary discussions. And the twist is that these experts are referred to as explorers, and that's because they're not told in advance exactly what they're going to be talking about. Now, if this has piqued your curiosity and you'd like to attend, and again, it's completely free of charge, you can find a link to sign up in the show notes. But as we heard a couple of minutes ago, the government is clear in its assessment that asylum immigration must be curtailed. And as we discussed last week, a lot of workforce migrants could soon be forced to leave the country. Now, given the increasingly negative portrayal of immigration in political circles, you'd be forgiven for thinking that immigrants have contributed very little to Swedish society. But Richard, you have a theory, don't you, that immigrants are in fact behind some of the most interesting initiatives in Sweden in recent years?
Well, I don't know if it's a theory, but anecdotally here in Malmö, I do notice that foreigners make a lot of things happen. And I started thinking about this more because I started this computer programming for children at my local RBF, because my son had done it and the company that ran it shut down. And so I kind of wanted to do it, so I just started it up. And, you know, it strikes me that none of the Swedish parents did that. And I wonder whether foreigners are more likely to kind of be more entrepreneurial in that kind of way. And there's this new, there's a lot of it in the moment. Like there's this big new street festival called NGBG that takes over kind of warehouses and car mechanic places on Norrgrenjeborgsgatan, which is this industrial area outside Malmö where a lot of illegal clubs used to be. So it's a kind of countercultural centre. It's like a kind of mini Berlin. And it's huge. I mean, if there's like 30,000 people, the whole street is packed. There must be like 20 bands playing at any one time in this kind of intense 24-hour period. And that started by an English guy called Ian Dace. And then there's the club also on Norrgrenjeborgsgatan, which has like become the live music venue in Malmö, started by an Italian guy. There's an English guy I know who used to run kind of electronica nights in a pub in Malmö. And he said that the Swedes he knew who were into this kind of slightly geeky electronic music kind of always wanted to kind of apply to the commune for a grant and then use it in some kind of public art space. Whereas he's just like, you know, just book the cellar of a pub and take 50 kroner on the door. It's much easier and quicker. So I think foreigners are more like that. I think a lot of Swedes are more like, have a tendency to want to go through the institutions that exist and, you know, join RBF or join one of the sports förenings in their village. And there's less of a kind of sense of, well, there's no rugby here, I'll start rugby for kids, or, you know. And obviously it's partly that foreigners want to recreate what they want from their life that's missing in Sweden. But like I say, it's also, I think Swedes tend to be more involved in clubs that have existed for years and less likely to start things from scratch. But I might be wrong about that.
And maybe it's a bit harder for foreigners also to get into those clubs that are already established. Like,
yeah,
for me as a Swede, it would be much easier to join an already established club than to have to start my own thing.
Hmm.
But maybe if you're coming here as a newcomer, those already established clubs are maybe run in Swedish. Maybe they don't advertise themselves very well. So you have to kind of be in the know to join them. You have to know somebody. So it's actually easier to start up your own thing.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just a lot easier. Exactly. I think you're right.
No, I think you're right too. We're in agreement. Very well
said,
Richard.
So is it a sign, Richard, of how Swedish you've become that you did this through RBF?
Yeah, that does kind of undermine my own argument. Yeah. But But I did look at other ways of doing it before I found RBF, which makes life so much easier. So that maybe is Swedish. Like, I've learned how to use the system, and you realize that it is really easy to do civil things through the systems that exist. There's so many organizations that can help you do various things that you want to do, you know, in your personal life in Sweden, that, yeah, you don't need to start things up on your own.
Yeah, we should probably recommend for anybody who hasn't listened to it, we had this bonus episode during the week, our interview with Anna Ekström, who's the chair of RBF in Stockholm. And she talked about just that, you know, how these educational institutions are an untapped resource for immigrants. You know, as soon as you find out how they work and what they do, you can use them to your benefit. I think it's something definitely worth exploring for people. But while we're on the subject of things that foreigners and readers of The Local are sort of disproportionately interested in, let's talk briefly about some upcoming and ongoing sporting and cultural events. I saw, for example, that we had an explainer on the site about where to watch the Cricket World Cup, which is taking place in India at the moment, and we'll link to that article in the episode notes. The Rugby World Cup is also happening in France, and we're now at the semi-final stage. Where can people watch the last few games, Emma?
So the second semi-final, which is England versus South Africa, it will be shown by Viasat Sport, or you can stream it via Viaplay online, although it's actually quite pricey in my opinion. But because actually, unlike the Cricket World Cup, the Rugby World Cup is actually being broadcast in Sweden. You can probably also just give your local sports bar a call and ask if it's on. O'Leary's is otherwise the big go-to pub chain in Sweden for watching sports.
Another thing that's happening, the Hindu festival Durga Puja is being celebrated at the moment. Richard, how is that being marked in Sweden for anyone wishing to participate?
I mean, I think that's kind of more evidence of foreigners starting things up that's kind of missing in their home country. I mean, apparently the joke among Bengalis is that if you get more than five of them living anywhere in the world, they start a Durga Puja. And it's the big religious celebration of the year for people from Bengal, which is the area of eastern India around Kolkata and also Bangladesh. It's got UNESCO recognition. And in Kolkata, the whole city shuts down for 10 days. And it celebrates Durga, who's a warrior goddess and the consort of Shiva.
But from what I understand, you don't have to be religious to celebrate it, right?
Yeah, no, exactly.
It's a bit like Christmas in Sweden.
It's quite like Christmas in Sweden, especially in Kolkata. Everyone in the whole city celebrates, whatever their religious background. And everyone is welcome to come and visit the celebrations in Stockholm as well. I mean, it's not just for Bengalis. There's two big celebrations happening in Stockholm. One is more of a cultural festival, and that's in the Järfälla Cultural Centre in northern Stockholm. And that's bigger and more food and more sort of dancing and stuff. And then there's a more devotional one, which is at the Hindu temple in Sundbyberg. There's also celebrations in Helsingborg, in Gothenburg, in Luleå, all over the place.
Another event coming up at the end of next month is the Women's Handball World Cup, which is being held jointly by Sweden, Norway and Denmark. Emma, where in Sweden are matches being held for anyone interested in getting tickets?
So in Sweden, matches are being held in Gothenburg and Helsingborg. And Sweden will be playing its group stage in Gothenburg against China, Croatia and Senegal. And in Helsingborg, it's Montenegro, Hungary, Paraguay and Cameroon. And I really recommend it. It's a fun sport, it's a fast sport, and the Swedish women's team has actually been looking increasingly promising. Although I think both Denmark and Norway are probably more likely to maybe be contender for the top spot. And the final will actually be played in Herning in Denmark.
Are you a handball fan?
I am a handball fan, Richard.
Do you play it?
I do not.
Okay.
Great, thanks both for that roundup.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
We'll move on now to the biggest story in Sweden this week, the terrorist attack that took place in Brussels on Monday evening, in which two Swedes were killed and a third sustained serious injuries shortly before Sweden's men's football team were due to play Belgium in a European Championship qualifying match. So let's recap what happened now before we get into analysis of why Swedes have become a target for Islamist terrorists. So first of all, how did the gunman carry out his attack?
So there have been videos shared online, which I do not recommend Googling. But they show how a man on a scooter, and he's wearing like an orange fluorescent jacket, and he pulls up and he just starts shooting people. And it happened kind of just north of the city centre in Brussels around 7 p.m. or so. You can also see how he chases people into an apartment building trying to shoot them. And then after that, he gets on his scooter and he just flees the scene. Then shortly after the attack, he filmed himself saying that he had killed Swedish people as revenge in the name of Muslims. Police actually only the following morning managed to track him down to a cafe where they shot him, and we later found out that he died from those injuries. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack, but that's probably more kind of in a broader sense because they've been encouraging attacks like these. But prosecutors seem to believe that like everything indicates that this man sort of acted alone, which of course people didn't know at first. So there was a lot of initial concerns from Swedes in Brussels, like, are there more shooters out there? Are we at risk right now? Should we be taking off our Swedish football jerseys? And so on.
Yeah, and he was still on the run that
exactly,
night.
Yes.
And when did news of the attack reach other supporters, and what was reaction like at the King Baudouin Stadium in Brussels among players, fans and officials?
DN interviewed some of the people who were there, and they're saying that almost as soon as kickoff started in the match, you know, just like just a few minutes after the match started, that people started to get alerts on their phones saying that a terrible attack had happened that seemed to target Swedish fans in Brussels. And they said, you know, you could just see how the atmosphere changed in the stadium in like the first 10, 20 minutes of the game, as more and more people stopped watching and just started looking at their phones. But the players carried on playing until half time. What the organisers said is that they had actually received news of the attack about 10 minutes before kickoff, but they decided to play it anyway because they thought, with a killer on the loose, the stadium's actually the safest place for the supporters and presumably the players to be. You know, they're in a safe area where they can protect all the entry points. But at halftime, the Swedish players said they didn't feel it was right to continue, and the Belgian players agreed, and then the match was stopped. And the fans were then held in the stadium for hours. I think the last left at about 4 a.m. So they were there for a good 6 hours after realizing what had happened. And the description was that the atmosphere was actually quite good, even though it was quite cold. And they kept their spirits up by singing songs all together and cheering Sweden, Sweden from both the Belgian side and the Swedish side. And after 2.5 hours, the Belgian supporters were allowed to go, after which the Swedish supporters were evacuated very slowly and carefully. Yeah. And they were told to remove any Swedish scarves and any Swedish colours, and they were given police escorts. I think some went directly to the airport. I'm not sure about that. Others went to their hotels where they had police guards outside for the night. And the Swedish Foreign Ministry also sent out text messages to all Swedish phone numbers in Belgium, telling them to remove any Swedish football shirts, skirts and scarves, and telling them how to behave. So I thought it was kind of, I didn't realise they could do that. You can just like send a blanket SMS to everybody in a country. And then people sort of started flying back, you know, the next day and came straight back to Sweden.
And a lot of politicians were obviously quick to condemn the attack, but there was some sort of political point scoring as well, wasn't there? A Sweden Democrat MP found herself in hot water over a message she posted on social media. Can you tell us about that, Emma?
So Fredrik Reinfeldt, who's a former moderate prime minister and is the new chair of the Swedish Football Association, he was there in the arena. And as soon as it happened, he was, you know, whisked away by security. He said afterwards that he had only been moved for a couple of dozens of meters and he was actually still in the arena. But Jessica Stegerud, who's the Sweden Democrat MP that you're referring to, she wrote on Twitter, or X as it's now called, that Reinfeldt was given a police escort out of the arena after two probably Swedish football fans were killed by an Islamist. He, if anyone, should have been forced to stay there with no police protection at all. My thoughts go to the dead and their families. My contempt goes to all the politicians, including Fredrik Reinfeldt, who laid the foundations for this. Now, like what she is referring to there when she says laid the foundation for this is probably a reference to like the kind of open immigration policy that Sweden had under the Reinfeldt era. Like he gave a famous speech in 2014 where he asked Sweden to like open their hearts to immigrants and refugees seeking safety in the country. Like one thing that you should remember is that her comments about this comes against the backdrop of two senior politicians in Sweden having been assassinated in just my lifetime. So, you know, there's a kind of a lot of tension around this. And Stegerud is also like widely touted as a possible successor to current Sweden Democrat leader Jimmie Åkesson. So she got a lot of criticism for that tweet.
How did the Prime Minister respond?
Well, this kind of touches a little bit on what we were talking about earlier about who runs the show in the government, because the Prime Minister, Ulf Kristersson, who, by the way, was a minister in Fredrik Reinfeldt's government, he was a bit criticised by the opposition for being too weak when responding to this. He said that Stegerud had shown a lack of judgment, and this was definitely not the time for careless or reckless comments like that. But he also kind of said that it was a matter for the Sweden Democrats to deal with and not for him to sort of get involved with too much. So yeah, I don't know. The Sweden Democrats group leader in parliament, she called the criticism of the tweet ridiculous, because she argued that, well, the story here should be that two Swedes got killed and not that somebody tweeted about it.
And what do we know about the attacker and his motives?
He was called Abdeslam Lasswed. He's a 45-year-old man of Tunisian origin, and he had sought asylum in Belgium and been rejected and then disappeared and gone underground. So he was living as a sort of paperless refugee in Brussels. As to his motives, in his video that he uploaded, he claimed allegiance to Islamic State, and he said he had killed three Swedes in the name of God. So he didn't explicitly mention Quran burnings or explain why he had targeted Swedes. But Islamic State, along with at least four other Islamic terror groups, had called for revenge to be taken against Sweden after, you know, one or other of the Quran burnings there's been so far this year. So it could well have been related to the Quran burnings. He also followed an account on TikTok called Sweden Injustice, which spreads the theory that Swedish social services are kidnapping Muslim children. So it could have been that caused him to target Swedes. And finally, he had himself been in Sweden and had a pretty miserable time. So he had lived in a disused daycare facility for dogs, a hundagis, outside Gothenburg. And he had also been arrested in Malmö. Actually, it was a flat in Malmö that got raided by the police, and they found 100 grams of cocaine, which he then claimed was for his own use. And so he was then sent to prison for that. So he in prison, he seems to have had a pretty tough time, and he threatened a female prison guard that he would stab her if they met her on the outside, that he would knife her if they ever met on the outside. And he said, pluck out her eyes or something. It's pretty, that's according to Aftonblad. I don't know if that's true. And he was frequently placed in solitary confinement after fights with other inmates. He also called to be able to see an imam. So there's this kind of mixture of kind of extreme violence and sort of religious devotion. After his prison sentence, he was then sent back to Italy because he had first arrived in Lampedusa in 2011, I think. And it also turns out that he had had problems with the law in Tunisia. He had been arrested and imprisoned in Tunisia as well. So he's a pretty rough character. And also on the days before the attacks, he had been active on social media and commented on the murder of a six-year-old Palestinian-American boy in the US, which other people outside Sweden have proposed as a potential motive. But I reckon he's probably planned this before, because these matches are planned months and months in advance. So he would have known that Sweden and Swedish supporters were coming to Brussels, you know, 6 months ago, if he had done his research. So it could have been planned for months.
Yeah, and as Emma said, he was shot dead by Belgian police the morning after the attacks. Emma, I don't expect you to speak for all Swedes, but can I ask how you reacted when you heard about the attack? I mean, does it feel personal when the perpetrator seems to be motivated by a hatred of Sweden?
All this hatred, it's just sad, and it's sad when people die in general. So I don't feel necessarily that it's personal in the sense of I'm Swedish, they were Swedish. And also I'm a journalist, so I'm used to reporting on grim events and kind of getting a bit detached from them. But I mean, one thing that I would say is something that has shifted in recent years, not just this incident, but that as a Swede, you were kind of used to people abroad liking you, or in the worst case, just ignoring you. And I think that's come to as a shock to a lot of Swedes, actually, that, well, we can't just go abroad and be Swedish and be loved for that.
Yeah, I mean, the image of Sweden abroad has taken a real hit, hasn't it, in the last few months with all the Quran burnings?
Yeah, I mean, it has in the past few years also. Like, I don't know, there's been so many things. I don't know, the refugee crisis and how Sweden responded to that in various ways has kind of affected the image in different ways in different circles, depending on who you ask. Sweden's move to the far right has affected the image. The handling of COVID has affected the image. Like, it's kind of got a bit more polarized. Not all of those things are related, of course, but
disinformation campaign about the Swedish social services kidnapping Muslim children. I mean, that has gained a lot of traction in certain circles, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. And that's been mentioned multiple times. I mean, the Swedish security services, when they raised the terror level threat in Sweden from 3 to 4 a few months ago, that was one of the things that they mentioned. Like, everyone focused on the Quran burnings at the time, but this disinformation campaign has had a huge impact, perhaps a bigger one than a lot of people realize. And I think a lot of people kind of, when they raised the terror threat level, started sort of like expecting that something might happen in Sweden. But I think Swedes perhaps didn't expect that they would be targeted outside of Sweden.
That takes us to the end of this week's episode. You can find links in the show notes to articles about the terror attack and all of the other topics we've talked about this week. Thank you for listening to Sweden in Focus, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. Our panelists this week were Emma Lovegrain and Richard Orange. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and we'll be back again next Saturday. Until then, take care.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
That's all for this week's free edition of Sweden in Focus. If you'd like to hear a full-length version of the podcast each week, as well as an additional midweek episode with more interviews and analysis, please upgrade to Membership Plus. Make sure to check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade. Sweden in Focus is a podcast by The Local Europe. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. The publisher is James Savage.